Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with Peggy Huppert. She's Executive Director of NAMI Iowa, the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Iowa. Ask her about the comments made by President Trump in the aftermath of those shootings in El Paso and Dayton, the president calling for reforms to the nation's mental health laws. But first, we know farmers have faced the impact of severe weather, also lower commodity prices, and now another blow after China recently announcing it was cutting off all new purchases of U.S. agricultural exports. Let's check in with Donnell Eller, a business writer at the Des Moines Register. Hi, Donnell.
Hi. How are you, Ben?
Donnell, you'll be writing in this Sunday's Register about all of this, the latest developments. What aspects are you focusing on?
We're really talking with farmers about how they think this new news will affect them. They've already gone through a lot of pain, which has been offset by some $28 billion in federal payments spread over 2 years. But they are really sort of digging in for what could be a multiple-year trade war and loss of markets.
Mm-hmm. For those of us not in the ag business, tell us, how have farmers been coping with this two-year trade war and the lower commodity prices?
Well, farmers generally store their grain as much as they can, waiting for sort of the best opportunity to sell it. So they have seen a little bit of a rally in prices, primarily due to the terrible spring flooding that we had that prevented a lot of farmers from even planting a crop, and they've called that prevented planting. But a lot of farmers have been paying bills, sort of making ends meet with that market facilitation payments that have come in two big chunks of $12 billion last year and $16 billion this year.
Mm-hmm. I was looking at a recent poll online of farmers showing still strong support for President Trump, even amid these rising tariffs. Donnell, I guess it's too early to say how this decision to stop buying U.S. ag products by China will affect that support. But here, I don't know if you saw this, the Purdue Center for Commercial Agriculture's latest producer survey, which was conducted last month, released Tuesday, showing a record high 78% of farmers say they still believe the trade war will ultimately benefit U.S. agriculture. Is that matching up with what you're hearing from farmers?
I think that farmers have really have tried to have the long view in this trade war, even though trade deals, free trade, really have benefited them, really opening up U.S. or foreign markets for U.S. products. In this story that I've written for Sunday, I am starting to get a sense that with questions around the potential for a third round of trade assistance, that with real questions on whether the federal government can do that, there are questions about whether that farm support might continue.
Mm-hmm. Do you get a sense of how farmers, Iowa farmers, are feeling about these, $28 billion in financial assistance?
I think they sort of see it as a necessary evil. They really don't want to get farm or to get government subsidies, in Iowa, Iowa State University economists have sort of estimated that Iowa's economy will take a $2 billion hit every year that this trade war goes on, and the brunt of that is going to farmers. So the real damage is being felt by farmers, and they really do need some help in getting through this.
Okay. Donnell Eller, business writer at the Des Moines Register. Check out her article that will be coming out this Sunday on trade war and its impact on Iowa farmers and Midwest agriculture. Danelle, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back on Monday, after those back-to-back shootings in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio over the weekend, killed at least 31 people, President Trump called for reforms to the nation's mental health laws.
We must reform our mental health laws to better identify mentally disturbed individuals who may commit acts of violence and make sure those people not only get treatment, but when necessary, involuntary confinement. Mental illness and hatred pulls the trigger, not the gun.
Well, let's get a reaction to the president's claims about the connection between gun violence and mental illness from Peggy Huppert. She's executive director of NAMI Iowa, the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Iowa. Peggy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what are your thoughts when you hear that characterization by the president of the causes of this epidemic of mass shootings?
Well, it's false, first of all. All our data shows that only mental illness contributes to only about 4% of all violence, and the contribution to gun violence is even lower. One of the things is we need to separate out hate and anger from mental illness. Hate and anger are not mental illnesses. I know that there's a general belief out there that for someone to commit this kind of atrocity, they must be like not right.
Right. If you go out and kill 20 people indiscriminately, right, how can you say that person is not mentally ill? So your answer to that is?
They are not. Hate and anger are not mental illnesses. They're emotions. And they're not caused by a brain disease. They are controllable. They're not like being in psychosis when you are hearing voices instructing you to do certain things, and you really are not in control of your faculties. So I don't know the specific circumstances of the two young men, the shooters from this past weekend, but to automatically assume that they are mentally ill is incorrect. It adds to the stigma of people with serious mental illness. It makes us more afraid because they're harmful, they're dangerous, they're going to hurt us. And that just isn't true. Most people with serious mental illness are much more likely to be the victim of a crime than the perpetrator of a crime. So this linking is just perpetuates the stigma, and it's very hurtful to people living with serious mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, and of course you talk with people, of course, in your position of people with mental illness all across Iowa, across the country, do you hear firsthand accounts of what this characterization does, makes people feel, their reaction to it?
Absolutely. My husband is one of them, and I know how he feels about it. It's hard enough to disclose and to seek help with the stigma that's already out there. When something like this happens and our president links mental illness and even talks about involuntary commitment, we're going to have to lock them up if we think they might do something, which, by the way, we can't do because, if you contact police and you say, I'm afraid I think this person is going to do something dangerous, there's nothing they can do. And I don't know if that's what the president is talking about, that he thinks we should preemptively lock people up based on a fear of what they might do. But I think there's some serious constitutional issues with that idea. Mm-hmm. So now there are proposals for things like the red flag laws, which when people can, usually it's a close family member or friend, can petition the court and say, I am very concerned about this person in my life because they have made statements that they are planning to harm themselves or harm others, and I happen to know that they have weapons. And so they have the means, and they've expressed the will. And I think that as a result, we should consider separating them from their weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that certainly in cases of suicide, having the means is the number one predictor of whether the person will try to do that or not. So then you can go to the court, and there's a process for that. And there's also an appeal that can be done. So it's done through a judicial process.
But
that's very different from talking about preemptively locking people up.
Right. But if I'm not mistaken, Iowa does not have such a law.
Iowa does not.
And we have, if I'm remembering correctly, a bill in that direction that did not make it out of committee last session.
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. So do you expect this to be impetus, this tragedy to be impetus?
I do. I expect there to at least be some more discussion about it. I've heard a lot more politicians across the country expressing support for this idea. I'm a little dubious as to whether it's going to advance because the NRA is opposed to it.
Mm-hmm. And because we have a history of these horrific events happening, mm-hmm. these deaths, and they just fade, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
They just fade.
And this is August, and they don't come back into session until January.
Right.
And yes, unfortunately, by that time, it unless it happens again, which in all probability, unfortunately, it will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Peggy, before we go, I want to go back to the Trump administration. The actions that the Trump administration in 2.5 years in office has made, when you look at it on a whole, have the actions taken by this administration made it easier or harder for people to obtain the mental health care that the president seems to be also advocating?
Well, actually, the administration's actions or lack of them have made it harder. And I'll just point out one major way that's happened is calling for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act has been the single biggest factor in making health care available to people with serious mental illness, especially single men. By the way, young single men under the age of 25 are at the highest risk of suicide and committing gun violence, but they are the most at risk for not having access to appropriate mental health care because they are often uninsured. The Affordable Care Act says that they have to be allowed to be covered under their parents' policies up to age 26. And then after that, they can access under the Medicaid expansion in many states, including Iowa. It's included 133,000 Iowans who previously were excluded from Medicaid. It's the single largest payer of mental health services in the nation of any other source is Medicaid. So by trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act and the coverage of pre-existing conditions, the allowance of young adults to remain on their parents' policies, those are all part of the Affordable Care Act, along with Medicaid expansion, would seriously harm our ability to extend mental health coverage to the people who need it the most.
Mm-hmm. So do you see the president, in a sense, contradicting himself, saying, well, we've got to focus on mental health and mental health service in order to also partially remedy this epidemic of mass shootings?
It was the same thing that was said after the Parkland shootings. It was the same thing that was said after Sandy Hook and the Charleston church shootings. You know, these are all troubled young men. They should have somehow been identified and helped. And we agree with that. We agree that there need to be more mental health services and outreach. And that actually starts in, honestly, elementary school. But you don't achieve that by stigmatizing people with serious mental illness, linking them to mass shooters, and suggesting that they be preemptively locked up.
Do other countries do a better job of this, Peggy?
Other countries do a better job of this, and that's the other thing I like to point out, is that when people want to blame mental illness for mass shootings, what they don't understand is the United States does not have a corner on mental illness. We don't have a lot more people suffering with mental illness than any other country. Rates are remarkably consistent the world over. About 1%, for example, of people in the entire world have schizophrenia. You know, the rates are very consistent. What's different about the United States is that we have way more guns, and people have much easier access to them.
Okay, Peggy Huppert, Executive Director of NAMI Iowa, the National Alliance on Mental Illness in Iowa. Thank you for your views, Peggy.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
It's our Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to end the week. King versus Scholten. It's a rematch in Iowa's 4th Congressional District race. Perhaps. This week, J.D. Scholten, the Democrat, who surprised political analysts by coming close to unseating the longtime Republican Congressman Steve King in 2018, announced he's running for that office, Iowa's 4th Congressional District, again. Let's talk with Katie Pikus, Western Iowa reporter with Iowa Public Radio. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Ben.
How much of a surprise was Scholten's announcement?
I think there's been speculation for a little while that he was going to run again. Some people were pushing for him to run for the U.S. Senate as well. So when he made the announcement that he was going to again be running for Iowa's 4th Congressional District, I think a lot of people were more just very, very happy, not really that shocked.
Mm-hmm. Scholten made himself available to the press, and you were there. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so he held a rally in a Sioux City parking lot. I'd say between 40 to 50 supporters showed up, and it was really about getting his message out again, saying what he's going to do this time around in campaigning, which he'll be taking the same approach as last time, traveling the district in a Winnebago RV, holding town halls in every county. And his motto this time around is a very similar message to his motto last time around. It's all about fixing health care, fighting for an economy, and, you know, securing democracy. So he talked a lot about that. And I have some tape from him talking about kind of his strategy and fighting for the people of the 4th District.
Whether it's from Larchwood to Collins, Lake Mills to Missouri Valley, we have far too many people who are working their tails off and not getting ahead. We have too many Iowans that are being forgotten and being left behind in these towns, and too many children moving away, and too many teachers not having the resources they need to educate. We're going to fix healthcare. We're going to fight for an economy that works for all of us, and we're going to secure this democracy by getting rid of the special interest that is currently dictating our democracy.
Democrat J.D. Scholten there announcing his new campaign to face Steve King in the 4th District of Iowa. He just made the announcement this week, but Katie, what can you tell us about the reaction there in the 4th?
People are just so happy. I mean, I spoke with a couple of Democrats at the Sioux City rally. One of them had told me, you know, that he feels the values that Scholten represents are just so important, that and that he truly represents the core of believing in people and bringing people together. I mean, he was really just this average guy with no political record running for Congress for the last election. So I think a lot of people really appreciated that.
Mm-hmm. Before Scholten can run against Steve King in the general election, Steve King will a nine-term congressman facing primary challengers next year. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so King has three primary challengers, and they include State Senator Randy Feenstra of Hull, Mayor Brett Richards of Irwin, and Jeremy Taylor, who is a Woodbury County supervisor. And, you know, that's a big group of people currently. King has been holding these town halls in the district this year in kind of a 39-county town hall tour similar to Scholten. So he's really been working to get his name out there and let people know that he is running again for a 10th term.
Right. These primary challengers coming into the picture after Steve King earlier this year, stripped of congressional committee assignments by House Republicans, by his own leadership there. This came after that big controversy. He questioned in, I think, a New York Times interview, why white nationalism was offensive, later saying what he had nothing to apologize for. He's made some divisive language, had some divisive language about Latino immigrants. And that is a big part of the agricultural economy there in the 4th District, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But I think that King still has a very, very large group of supporters here who have been with him from his side on day one. And they feel that a lot of what he says maybe gets misinterpreted on a national level. I mean, I went to King's very first town hall in the district in Trimgar shortly after the comment that was published in the New York Times. And there were still a lot of supporters who said, we believe in you, we stand with you, and this is not who you are, and we know
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is interesting. So we'll be watching that primary. If King is beaten in the primary, and I think then it's a whole different race with J.D. Scholten, isn't it?
It will be, and we will have to see how that plays out.
Okay, very good. And J.D. Scholten coming out, I noticed this week, with a campaign ad voiced by Kevin Costner. Did that make a splash there in Western Iowa?
I think it did. I didn't really talk to a lot of people about that, to be honest. But I think that, I mean, it was a totally different way, a much bigger way of him announcing his run again in comparison to the first time around.
Katie Pikus, Western Iowa reporter with Iowa Public Radio. Thanks.
Thanks, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, our Home State View series continues. Home State View is a series that we're doing on the 2020 presidential candidates, and we'll focus on Marianne Williamson, the author. We'll talk with the Los Angeles-based reporter at Quartz, Jenny Avins. And then, a real treat, we'll talk with three members of the Cedar Rapids Sizzlers. Never heard of them? They are Granny Basketball League national champions. As of a few days ago, we'll talk with three members of that team. Yes, there is such thing as Granny Basketball, and we'll find out about it more when we return. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer, back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, now let's continue our Home State View series during this caucus campaign season. It's a series in which we look at 2020 presidential hopefuls with media professionals in their home state. And today we focus on the author and Democratic presidential candidate, Marianne Williamson. To do that, let's talk with Jenny Avins. She's a reporter for Quartz based in Los Angeles. Jenny, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It's nice that you are able to do this because Marianne Williamson, you will agree, is a different sort of candidate than most of the other Democratic candidates, not an established politician, not an office holder up to this point. With that in mind, tell us about her rise in prominence as an author and then an activist.
Yeah, so she first became famous after publishing her first book in the early 90s, which is called A Return to Love. And that book is really kind of the cliff notes on another spiritual guide from the 70s, called A Course in Miracles, and the book really took off after Oprah featured it on her show, and Oprah has continued to feature Marianne Williamson in the years since. But that book and sort of The Course in Miracles are all about this kind of single idea that a miracle is a shift in perception, and that the sort of ultimate miracle is a shift from fear to love. And that idea has fueled so much of her writing and teaching and work over the last few decades. And now we really see it as the cornerstone of a political campaign.
Mm-hmm. And so she has a following, right, with her work here.
Yeah, she has a very big following. She sold many millions of books. When I saw her speak a couple times in L.A., it was interesting. Most of the people who were there were people who were familiar with her from reading her books. I talked to more than one person who was sober and said that, you know, she had sort of helped with their recovery. Also, people who'd been through painful experiences. More than one person said to me, she changed my life. And you really got the feeling at these engagements that many of these people were not people who were politically involved before. They were fans who would have been there to see her speak regardless.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more about Marianne Williamson's activism. And she also ran for Congress once, didn't she?
She did. Yeah. So she was sort of teaching courses based on these books that I told you about in the 80s in Los Angeles when the AIDS crisis hit, and started a couple nonprofits, at least one of which is still operating today, called Project Angel Food, which provides sort of non-medical services to people in need. And in 2014 or 2015, she ran in the congressional primary here in Los Angeles, in the district that includes Bel Air and Beverly Hills, as an independent. And she came in fourth. She didn't make it. And it's interesting. I heard her say, you know, that after that run, she was pretty sure she was done with politics, but that for her, the election of Donald Trump changed everything.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about when she crosses into the political arena, that part of her activism? How does she conduct herself at a political rally? Is it different than her persona as an author and as a sort of spiritual guide?
Well, it's funny. Here in L.A., the first time I saw her, you know, it was after she'd announced her run. It was after the first time she appeared on the debates, actually. And the theater that she spoke at is a theater that she has spoken at many times. I think she used to have sort of like a regular Monday night series there. And so many of the people there were her fans from before, who'd seen her at this theater many times. And, you know, I spoke to one woman and I asked her the same question, you know, is this different than when you've seen her before? And she said, you know, no, that she was worried she wasn't going to get sort of the Marianne Williamson that she knew and loved, but that, you know, she was very much the same. But now I think you really can see a shift. I mean, on Trevor Noah, I think it was just this week, she was ready to talk more about policies than I think she has been. She still frames policies in a sort of moral framework, and I think we'll probably continue to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But you do see her sort of toning down the kind of woo-woo stuff even more than she already has. And that was a perception she fought in her congressional run, too. She said outright to the New York Times, you know, I'm not a woo-woo silly person. But at the same time, she was photographed in her living room with a crystal ball on her table. So, you know.
Right. And we she's distinctly different from, at least in the last Democratic presidential debate, different than the others in that she will have phrases like, you know, describing Donald Trump in terms of, I'm not sure if I'm quoting exactly, but something like dark forces. So it's a different vocabulary she uses and different imagery she brings to mind.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that that's also part of that's part of her strategy. I mean, she said flat out to her, you know, fellow candidates in the first debate that, you know, Donald Trump didn't get elected with a plan. He got elected by saying, make America great again. And I think that she's trying, you know, to do a similar thing and really speak in very simple, emotional language that anyone can understand, and sort of that's easy to tune into in a sense.
Mm-hmm. You talked about she's getting firmer or on talking about policy. Can you list some of her policies that seem to be a top of list?
Yeah, I mean, I think for her, a lot comes back to campaign reform. You know, public funding for federal campaigns, because she just, you know, will say again and again that this political system is corrupt and that, you know, we're in the pocket, or that politicians are in the pockets of corporate interests, and that is sort of, I think, to her, the fundamental issue from which so many others spring. She also talks about eliminating subsidies to fossil fuel companies. She talks about, I mean, reparations has been something that she's gotten a lot of attention for talking about during this campaign. But it's interesting, she's been talking about that for 20 years. She wrote a book in 2000 called Healing the Soul of America, in which she says very frankly that, you know, this country is not going to progress until we can sort of apologize and atone for our mistakes in a real and financial way. Mm-hmm. So those are a few. She's also said, you know, she agrees with Elizabeth Warren that billionaires should get a 3% tax.
She would be in the class of a 1%er, I would assume, with her popularity.
I don't know if she would be that high, but possibly.
Mm-hmm.
She's had a very successful career, certainly. I think one of her other big ones is universal preschool and educational reform.
Let me ask you this. We've been asking this about all of the candidates on this Home State View series. Well, let's just frame it this way. We have a president who responds to criticism by punching back, and punching back, if possible, harder than the initial whatever he perceived as aggression. How does Marianne Williamson respond to criticism?
So I think she does it pretty directly, actually. And like the president, she's very, you know, she's active on social media. She will come out on Twitter and sort of explicitly reply to things. You know, she has said on Twitter repeatedly that she's pro-science, she's not anti-vaccine, you know, that she sees what's being said about her and responds directly. And then I think also a little bit with humor. You know, on Instagram, she's reposted some of the memes. I think I saw this week she might have posted something that was like herself in a Game of Thrones role. And, you know, she sort of laughed it off a little. In L.A. at one of her appearances, she said something like, you know, what is a Mid-Atlantic accent anyway? Because she sort of knew that everybody was trying to place that, you know, her way of speaking after the first debate.
Finally, before we say goodbye, Jenny, this has been a wealth of information you've given us, but I wonder if you can tell us something about Marianne Williamson that we might not know about from the national news coverage, a little known fact, if you will.
Yeah, sure. I mean, something that I found really interesting in talking to people that does not come up in her writing much is that she had this stint in Michigan in the late 90s and early 2000s, at a church that was then called Renaissance Unity, that she came in as sort of the new leader of this church and kind of turned it around. You know, that it was, I think, sort of a small and struggling congregation, and she turned it into this sort of bustling, diverse mega church with a gospel choir that became the second biggest Unity church in the country. And her friend Steven Tyler, the former, or not former, still the front man of Aerosmith, came, I think, in 2001 and sang Amazing Grace with the choir there. It was a whole thing.
Wow. Connection with Steven Tyler of Aerosmith. Interesting.
Well, I mean, she has a lot of celebrity connections, but I think it's interesting that she sort of, you know, she brought it to this church in the heartland.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Jenny Avins is a reporter for Quartz based in Los Angeles. And Jenny's been helping us out as we continue our Home State View series during the caucus campaign season, looking at presidential hopefuls with media professionals from their home state. Jenny Avins, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Basketball, a fast-moving game of pivots, quick jump shots, fast breaks. Certainly a game for the young. But wait, just a minute. Granny basketball continues to grow. Yes, I said granny basketball. There are now more than 450 players on 37 teams in 9 states: Kansas, Louisiana, Minnesota, Missouri, Oklahoma, Texas, Virginia, Wisconsin, and here in Iowa. Granny basketball not only provides fun and competitive exercise for women over the age of 50, it's also an avenue for charitable giving and a way of preserving the history of 6-on-6 basketball. And did you know the National Granny Basketball Tournament was just held in Lawrence, Kansas?
When it's all said and done, only one team can be the champion. Only one team can reach the summit. To be crowned the Granny Basketball National Champion.
Okay, part of a promotional video from the National Granny Basketball League. Joining me in the studio, 3 national champion athletes, 3 members of the Cedar Rapids Sizzlers, the 2019 winners of the National Granny Basketball Tournament held in Lawrence, Kansas in July. Sue Hartley, Diana Marker, and Margaret Buter are sitting across from me. Congratulations, ladies.
Well, thanks.
Very well done for Cedar Rapids and for your Sizzlers. This was a 16-team tourney featuring 200 women from 10 states, ranging in age from 50 to 87. Who wants to take the lead? Tell us about the championship. I understand the final game was decided in overtime against the defending national champs, the Harper's Ferry Fireflies. Sue.
Yeah, it was so exciting. You have to know that we played 5 games that day. And for old women, that's a lot. We got down to the final game. We were ahead by 5 that final game, and the mayor was there even and rooting for us, and they tied it up. So we had to go to overtime, and I think our stamina just beat them.
So overtime means the clock was extended, or was
4 minutes? Yep, had a 4-minute overtime. Of course, I fouled out in the last 30 seconds, but we still won by 1 basket.
Congratulations! Yeah. So it, what was the final score? Anybody have that?
53-51 was the final score.
Okay, Margaret. So I see your team has also won the national titles in 2012 and 2015. This is a sports dynasty. No? Were you on that team? Were any of you on that team as well?
Yeah, we were.
You, all 3 of you were.
No, I was not.
Okay, Margaret you're the newcomer,
yes.
But Diana and Sue were.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we've had a lot of the teammates together now, and it flows. You know, there's a rhythm. You've got to watch our forwards play. It just flows there.
Tell us about how this is different than basketball people think of today, because this is, as I said, preserving the history of 6-on-6 basketball was the basketball that women played before Title IX changed things, right?
Mm-hmm. Margaret?
Diana, tell us how that difference is, Diana.
Okay, 6-on-6 in high school was 3 players on one court and 3 players on another court, forwards on one court, guards on another court. Now we have 2 players in the forward court, 2 players in the center court, and 2 guards in the guard court. You're not supposed to run, no jumping. A lot of passing, yes.
Okay, so passing, uh-huh. And you sort of stay in your sectors, your region.
Mm-hmm. We hurry a lot.
You yes. hurry.
What we is it, hurry a lot.
What does
we,
that mean?
We move very quickly, even though we're not running.
what is the age range on your team?
We figured out on our way home after we won the national championship that our average age is 66. So we have a 56-year-old player and an 81-year-old player.
Mm-hmm. Are you all previous basketball players from earlier in your lives?
Unfortunately, I never had the opportunity to play basketball.
Margaret speaking.
Williamsburg High School, and we did not have basketball, so the only sport I had was track. And I did try out at UNI, but did not make the team. But mm-hmm. So this is living the dream that I get to play granny basketball.
Tell me about Margaret, for you, for instance, or the others. How did you get into this? I would imagine that, you know, as you get older, you might have some concerns about getting in a competitive game like basketball. Did you have those concerns? Diana?
Yes. I was actually recruited in 2005. I was one of the original members of our team, but that was definitely a concern. But as I saw the others playing, I thought, I can do this.
Yeah.
And the person who started our team is a sister of Barb Trammell, who started the whole league in 2005. Mm-hmm. And the person was Linda Turper. Mm-hmm.
And Linda also, this is Sue, mm-hmm. and Linda Turper also recruited me after I had retired. I taught with her, actually, at Pierce Elementary School. So she grabbed me, and I said, oh, this is fun. It's exercise. Keeps me out of trouble. And I had played other sports. I did play in high school. Back in New York, mm-hmm. we had high school.
Did you want to?
I was going to say that Williamsburg was celebrating their sesquicentennial, and I believe that one of my classmates, actually Roberta Wardenberg, happened to be on the Cedar Rapids Sizzlers team, and they said, Williamsburg, you got to get a team together for this sesquicentennial. And as it turned out, then they continued to have a team, and that's how I started to play with them mm-hmm. to begin with.
So you have a lot of fun together, socializing, exercise, but there's also this charitable side of it. How does that work? Diana?
The teams can set up benefits. Sometimes they might play against teachers of a school, police groups, firemen. And we have the organizations that have benefit from our games are... help me out with this, Sue.
We have had Bridgehaven and Waypoint and Horizons Meals on Wheels. We've got Grateful Grannies who do school supplies to kids that are in need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we all know as we get older, we all face some health challenges. And I know you're okay with me sharing this as well. Diana, you connect this with a major health challenge that you faced years ago.
Yes, in 2010, I was undergoing treatment for lymphoma, and everybody connected with Granny Basketball was extremely supportive, and I really needed a distraction, and Granny Basketball was a great way for me to think about other things besides myself.
Mm-hmm. How long do each of you think you'll continue to play Granny Basketball? Margaret, you're the newcomer in this group.
I want to continue as long as I can. My mom was turning 90, and I'm hoping I'm still playing when I'm 90.
What about you, Sue?
Sounds good to me, yeah. And I already informed my pastor that I'm going to die on a court, so be ready, you know, whether it be volleyball or basketball or pickleball, yeah.
Somehow, on a court, it will happen. All right. Mm-hmm. In a blissful state, I understand your meaning there. And Diana, what about you?
As long as they'll put up with me, I'll be there.
Okay, very good. We're going to go out with some basketball music, but I want to thank you and congratulate you again, three national champion athletes, three members of the Cedar Rapids Sizzlers, the 2019 winners of the National Granny Basketball Tournament, held last month in July in Lawrence, Kansas. I've been speaking with Diana Marker, Sue Hartley, and Margaret Buter. Congratulations, and keep the dynasty going, I guess. You'll have more competition in the future. I think this Granny Basketball is something that will really catch on.
I think you're right. Thanks so much, Ben.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Favorite sport. I like to win. way to dribble up and down the court, just like I'm the king on the microphone. So it's Dr. J and Moses Malone. I like slam dunks and take me to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley.
River to River is available as a podcast. If you'd like to share this conversation or any of the conversations today or on other days, just go to iowapublicradio.org. You can download our app. It's a good way not to miss out, and share this discussion with other people. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Shirley Wong, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
And Jerry West play basketball at its very best. Basketball has always been my thing. I like Magic Bird and Bernard King.